who manages social impacts evaluation services. And sorry, the five-year contract with USAID for evaluation services in the Department of State. She provides technical assistance, training, capacity building, and program management support to global evaluations across various thematic issues. She has a master's from Columbia University in economy and political development, and with a concentration in post-conflict emergency settings. And here is Kelly. Let's give her a big hand.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here today. I'm not sure if many of you have heard of Social Impact. We're a small, well, for now, a small consulting firm in Arlington, and we primarily work with USAID, MCUC, the State Department, and the World Bank on monitoring and evaluation, training and capacity building, and organizational strengthening. So myself, I'm in charge, like I said, of a five-year contract with USAID and the Department of State to work on evaluation of their foreign assistance funds. And so one of our first projects under this evaluation services contract was an evaluation of the implementation of the USG adherence to the Paris Declaration on Aid Effectiveness. So this is kind of the USG report card section of the presentations, I guess. So what Elizabeth discussed in her presentation was that we were a part of the donor agency study. So there was, and I have it here, how many were involved. There were different 18. Phases.
Yeah,
18 involved. So I'll go into that in more detail. My main disclosure for this presentation is that I do work for Social Impact, who was hired to do this evaluation. So the evaluation was managed by the Office of the Director of U.S. Foreign Assistance, known as the F Office, and it was published by USAID and conducted by my firm, Social Impact. So it was a USG-wide effort. So I'm going to talk about the international evaluation and our overall USG findings, and then a discussion of one of our case studies, which was the Department of Health and Human Services. So I do not need to go over this because we have heard this at length, which was a very nice setup to this. So we know of the Paris Declaration and its five principles. The global evaluation, like I said, was done by an independent evaluation through the OECD DAC, and the USG was a participant as one of the donor case studies, so my firm conducted that case study for the USG. And it is our findings were then put into the overall international synthesis report, which is what's going to be presented in Busan. So the objective of our study was to assess the USG's commitment to and efforts towards implementing the Paris Declaration. Specifically, we had these four primary scopes of, in our scope of work, four primary enablers. So we said that the commitment, capacity, incentives, and disincentives, and coherence would be the four things that we look at. This is an overview of our methods and some methodological issues we found. The way this was set up was that we were to do seven agency case studies. So as you all may know, there's approximately 27 U.S. government agencies that distribute foreign assistance funds. We were assigned seven major agencies to do a case study on, and then the case studies fed into our overall synthesis report. So we did case studies on the Department of State, USAID, Health and Human Services, MCC, Department of Labor, USDA, and Treasury's OTA department. And to preemptively answer a question that I get asked all the time, why was DOD not on the list? You can take that up with the F office. They were not, they chose not to be a part of the study, and we did not have much say in that. So that would be a caveat to some of our findings, I feel. And in terms of interviewing, we interviewed, obviously, people at all of these agencies, and then in addition, we did a survey of 140 USG missions abroad with mainly USAID and Department of State officials answering this survey. The real core of the study, though, is to look at our at what's going on at headquarters, though, because there were country studies being done as a part of the international evaluation, so keep that in mind. In terms of methodological issues, there are a couple here. One I want to highlight is the transitional political environment. This was really crucial because we were doing our study in we began February of last year, and we ended actually in officially April of this year. So as you can imagine, we conducted all of our interviews between February and probably July. And then in August and September, the QDDR came out and all these different things, which really affected some of the findings, because we were finding, as this first bullet point says, Paris Declaration was known, was kind of in the air, as we said, but it wasn't on the ground. But then as we started drafting the report, it was starting to be put on the ground in terms of these policy directives. So that caused some issues for us. One other thing I do want to say with that is kind of a disclaimer about me as a part of this study. I co-authored the Department of State and Department of Labor studies and also assisted with the synthesis report. I did not co-author the Health and Human Services report. So that the author of that was George Grobe, and he's sorry he cannot be here today to answer specific questions. I'm going to describe his findings, but in terms of going really in depth into some of the health initiatives, I can take if I can't answer it, I'll take it down and definitely get back to you. So in terms of our findings, and this is for the overall USG report, with awareness and commitment, overall we found that, well, in the words of one key informant, who said, I think we signed it in 2005 and then we promptly forgot about it. So that's not entirely fair. There was a lot going on at the higher level. There were committee meetings about it, about how to enact this, but all remained at the senior executive level. When we spoke with mid-level managers and junior level managers, it was not being translated to them. Beginning in 2008, which was when the Accra Agenda for Action was signed, they did start to take, especially within USAID, more active steps. And the PPD and QDDR, the U.S. Global Development Policy, came out with the three presidential initiatives, the Climate Change, Feed the Future, and Global Health Initiative. And these all actually do give a USG-wide management structure and speak many specifically to the Paris Declaration principles. Again, this was coming out towards the end of our research, but it is important to know. The one other thing is that, and we looked at this, was that a majority of the key informants, that's KIs on the slide, are conversant with the principles, but not as Paris Declaration. So what we ended up doing, because we would find in a lot of our interviews, you'd say, okay, what do you know about the Paris Declaration principles? And the typical answer was, I Googled them last night because I knew I was meeting with you. And so then we knew we needed to switch avenues. And so we would say, okay, this is the ownership principle. This is what it means. And then people would say, oh, yeah, we're doing that, and be able to speak more freely about it. So we called this PD-like processes as opposed to PD-branded processes. And that, that changed some of the findings. In terms of capacity, we found that the capacity required to implement the Paris Declaration within the agencies is underestimated. That we found that really it's within the agencies, the belief is that the host country capacity is limited in terms of implementing some of these five principles. And this, I will say, is not as applicable to HHS and Department of Treasury. This is because most of the international program mandates with those two agencies are actually specifically capacity building mandates. So it is different for those two agencies, and I'll discuss that a bit more with HHS. In terms of incentives and disincentives, following these, first of all, incentives-wise, there really is no specific incentive given by any of the agencies to implement Paris Declaration principles. That being said, across the board, everyone interviewed said it was their professional commitment to development, and they saw these as effective principles in theory, and that was incentive enough to implement them. In terms of disincentives, The main one cited was the congressional rules and regulations set on the agencies. So they said, great, all of this is wonderful in theory, but we have the Government Performance and Results Act, the FAR regulations, the Federal Acquisition Regulations, and at the end of the day, we have to report to Congress. We report on a yearly basis, so in terms of good development practice, of capacity building, which can take years, that really hinders us. And we want to show our results. So in terms of harmonization, that was a big issue. So if we're all working together, who gets credit? And as you know, as you want to say that that's not going to be the case, it is the case because you need to provide budget justifications to Congress, and that was a big issue. These survey findings are just to show something specifically from the USAID and State Department case studies. We asked how common is it to use the recipient country's own systems for procurement, how common is it to use the recipient country's own accounting and financial management systems. And this speaks to the alignment issue of aligning with country systems. And as you can see, 46% and 42% said rarely. What we found pervasively in these organizations is they're not using those due to regulations, but also an overall culture that is risk averse. And that really hindered people's ability to follow through on alignment. And, you know, we spoke with one key informant who at Department of State who said, if I'm responsible ultimately for where this money goes, I can't send it through this system. He was working in Afghanistan in the Education Department with the Ministry of Education. And, you know, he said, at the end of the day, it's my job on the line. So that was found across multiple agencies. In terms of coherence, I think one of the questions to Dan spoke to this, there's multiple objectives of U.S. foreign policy that are going to create a lot of contradictory policies that are going to undermine this. We categorize these into three distinct justifications, we call them, for aid. We said there's security justifications, economic growth justifications, and moral obligation justifications. And you can think of a million ways, I'm sure, and you've encountered it in your work, that these all conflict. A specific example was in our Department of Labor case study. A lot of their money is for child labor. And they said it's very difficult, if there's child labor going on in a country, to get the ownership of that country for us to do work there. And so they said because of many congressional earmarks for their funds, it's, you know, in terms of the U.S. and many other countries, it's a moral obligation to work on these types of programs anyway, so they're going to go in and do it anyway. But that wouldn't technically fulfill the ownership criteria. Another example cited is the Bumpers Amendment. This is an amendment to the Foreign Assistance Act in which support for agricultural research and assistance is limited to crops that do not threaten U.S. exports. So that's going to create some issues for following a country-led plan and other such things. And also, the Foreign Assistance versus ODA, and ODA is Overseas Development Assistance, or official development assistance. And what we mean by that is, and we found this primarily in the Department of State, where many people we spoke to didn't understand why we were even speaking to them because they felt as though the work they're doing is not considered development assistance. It's diplomacy work, and it should not be considered under these aid effectiveness principles. And there is actually no policy within the U.S. government as to what type of, I mean, they'll say that a fund is ODA, but it gets siphoned through so many different channels that it's hard to determine what's actual development assistance and what's not. So that's been troubling in terms of adhering to these principles. Some key conclusions, which are pretty clear from the findings I just discussed, that they are actively trying to reform the policies, and this is definitely clear in the last few months. There are aspects, and again, this reflects another question that was asked, of the Paris Declaration that are not going to apply in situations of fragility, accountable governance, and immediate post-conflict, and this really isn't discussed in a lot of the guidance. We also determined that it's unlikely that the U.S. government will ever achieve full compliance with the Paris Declaration. This is not only because of U.S. interests, but also we would need to see a behavior change in a lot of the different countries and specifically regime countries that we work with. Key considerations or recommendations. In terms of an overall recommendation is to monitor these new reforms. So, you know, they're getting guidance down on paper, what's going to actually happen. We suggest that the executive branch and leaders of each agency give a forceful and consistent statement on the USG commitment to the Paris Declaration. Many of the smaller agencies involved in international development work, HHS, OTA, and Department of Labor said that they are getting no guidance from USAID or Department of State on how they're supposed to be implementing this or speaking to their agency about it. And this goes into increasing mid-level management awareness. Also, agencies must assess the capacity required to carry out effective host country capacity strengthening. And actually, since we did this study, the USAID reform, or excuse me, the USAID Forward efforts are looking into how to assess this capacity so that they know exactly what functions within the agency to work on. Oh, and one other thing I want to say about that is, in general, awareness is not going to equal commitment. So in terms of creating that, they need to address constraints that are actually affecting the implementation of these programs. So the awareness of the Paris Declaration is definitely increasing. However, the commitment to it in terms of working on the risk-averse culture in some of these agencies needs to be more clear. Incentives and disincentives, guidance giving an analysis of favorable and unfavorable conditions for implementation of the Paris Declaration and what the U.S. government's going to do in these situations. USAID is actually preparing guidance on the use of country systems, which will be effective in terms of answering these questions. When do we use what aid effectiveness principle, or how do we conform an aid effectiveness principle in a certain situation? As we've discussed in a lot of these presentations, it differs country by country and situation by situation. Okay, so now to speak briefly about the Health and Human Services study specifically. There are six offices within the agency that receive international global health funding. And these are the six agencies. The estimated total HHS funding for international programs is about $2.2 billion. Again, our numbers are from fiscal year 2009. $1.7 billion of that is governed by PEPFAR and the Presidential Malaria Initiative funds. In terms of George and his team's methodology for this, he interviewed 21 senior and mid-level executives at HHS across all the agencies except the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, as their work internationally is minimal. CDC and the Office of Global Health Affairs are the two largest involved in this work, so the interviews favored people in that agency more in terms of there were more interviews with those agencies. In terms of our findings for this is presented a little bit different than the other agencies because the global health field is a little bit different, actually. There are no formal policies or procedures within HHS that reference the Paris Declaration principles. However, there was lots of exposure to it based on the long-term relationships with the WHO and other international organizations. So this is where HHS differed from a lot of the other agencies in terms of the long-term public health commitment to working internationally on a common goal. So George and his team rated it as practical commitment to action in the first line, which is an easy way to think of it is what are they saying? What's the agency saying in its policies? And then the actual results is what is it actually doing? And it's on a scale of 1 to 5, with 5 being the highest. So what we found, What we found in terms of the ratings for country ownership, one key aspect is that the many global health, and this isn't just HHS, have cooperative agreements, which inherently mean that you're gaining country ownership because you're working on country-led plans. So you're only working with countries that want you there. The problem that they found in implementation was that only willing partners means that sometimes your values-based money, as we discussed, can be in conflict with what you actually want to do. In terms of alignment, this was kind of the most controversial one that George found at HHS. Many of the key informants said that it's really hard to rely on country-based management systems and that it differs greatly across countries. And currently, the policies do not account for that. In terms of harmonization, as I said, the public health field has a long history of this. The one major issue was was results reporting, is taking success and being able to appoint it to a certain agency or intervention. Another issue raised with this was that the USG's heavy focus, for instance, on HIV/AIDS, at times distort some of the other public health issues in country, and that hurts the harmonization efforts with other agencies. In terms of management for results, the health field has a lot of international metrics, which many of the other agencies are incredibly jealous of. I'm thinking of a rule of law project is much more difficult to gain some actual M&E results on. However, this still varies in health. So there are really strong indicators in PEPFAR and other guidelines that Health and Human Services follows. However, there are still capacity building projects and other things that still vary in health and are very hard to manage for results. Mutual accountability, there's built-in capacity building in almost all of Health and Human Services projects. However, again, as we've said, it varies. There's corruption, there's poor country systems that will hurt this ability to actually see results in capacity building. The Global Health Initiative, just talk about this briefly, and there's people in the room that can probably speak more in depth about this, but this is showing how HHS is moving forward on this. In 2009, Obama announced this six-year, $63 billion plan to fight infectious diseases and other global health issues. The main thing is that all HHS international programs are subject to the principles of this. So right there is an overarching document that other agencies lack. And so we just kind of broke down the GHI principles and showed which ones line up with the Paris Declaration principles. And again, as I've said in this presentation, this is great, but it's still too early to tell how that's going to play out. And finally, these are some key considerations that George had for HHS. Overall, they're looking for guidance from USG lead agencies in implementation of the Paris Declaration. The guidance should provide practical information on, as you see here, the potential for fraud, development of partner country management capacity and adaptations to joint project plans, a disconnect between the policies and priorities of the U.S. government, accountability for senior HHS program officials, and then improvement of M&E, including impact evaluation for managing for results. That's it. Thank you. Sorry I went a little over.